Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, since he screwed up, welcome everybody to Carl's Music and Movie Emporium.
I was waiting for the song first. You didn't tell me. Well,
it's
I don't care about 1979. Okay, Steven, let me go. Because, A, it's one of my favorite groups of all time, which is the Kinks. It was a major, major song for me when I was in New York in the 80s. And right now, it's a major song, too, because I'm living on a low budget. So there you go. That's my take. Now, why don't you tell us why it's good for 1979?
Because everyone was really that broke and angry in 79. And really, this was the Kinks crossing over into punk territory. So
well,
how many
I
really
would argue
punk
that
bands covered this
I life? Would argue they're proto-punk to begin with, but that's, you know,
yeah.
Going back to 64 and that. I would argue that. But, yeah, you're right. They started to do some real punkish things in 79, and this album was a big one for them. And I love this album. It's a great friggin' album.
Oh, the album is great. This is the one album that the 80s fan, which I'm part of, and the 60s fans, which Carl is part of, really can get together and agree this was a good fucking album.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, they're a great group. And, of course, you know, Ray Davies was just knighted, which I think came a lot too late in his life. Man, the man is one of the great lyricists in rock and roll, if not the greatest. And it's a great song. So thanks for picking that one out, Stephen. I really appreciate it. So we're going to go on here, and we're going to start with 1979. And 1979 is chock full of stuff. Oh, my Lord. The stuff that came out this year, this is a premium year. And what we're going to do is we're going to start with the dramas today. And we're going to start with one of the big hits. Now, whatever you think of Woody Allen, you can think of Woody Allen. You know, I'm not a huge fan. I think he can be a really good filmmaker. There's some issue with his personal life. And actually, this movie sort of brings that out to a certain degree. And this was one of the big hits. And I remember seeing it in the theater and just absolutely astounded by the cinematography. And that, of course, would be Manhattan. Steven, you got any thoughts on Manhattan?
Yeah, it's good, but for me, it's a dry run for Stardust Memories. It's not as mean. And two things that one it brings up is one, Woody's attraction to young me. That's one of the major
always.
Jokes in there. Because they have like a 25-year-old girl and said, oh, I'm 25, I guess I'm too old for you.
Yeah.
And this
is the one
where you really started hearing the first rumblings of how white Woody's movies are, and he really never had any black characters.
Yeah,
even
and of course, it's also
the street.
And it's also the movie that really did bring out this age discrepancy in his preferences. And there were more than one reviewer out there that got a little skeeved with this movie, and I can understand that completely because the actors, it's not, is it Mariska Hargitay?
Margo.
I think. It was Margo. She was what? 15 at the time or 16, something
barely
like that?
Barely 18.
Well, it didn't look it, that's for sure. And it's an interesting film. I think it's a good film. I think the cinematography is just astounding. But the interesting, you know, the most interesting thing about it is one of Woody's biggest hits. I mean, this thing went huge. And so there you go.
And one of
so
my
you have
favorite
one
reviews, this will be real quick.
Okay, go.
One reviewer said that the relationship between Margot Hemingway and Woody Allen makes the relationship between her and Chris Sarandon in Lipstick less creepy.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But, you know, Stephen and I talk about images of New York a lot. And I'm sure we'll get a show out there about images of New York. So you have this image of New York, which is all glitter and beauty and uptown and so on and so forth. And on the opposite side of that, a little lesser known film comes out, and that would be Boardwalk. And Boardwalk is an interesting little film. It stars Lee Strasberg and Ruth Gordon, who I just adore, as an old couple who are living in Coney Island. And they're, you know, when they first moved there when they were young, it was a really nice neighborhood. But now the neighborhood has gone down and there are thugs out for protection and so on and so forth. And it's one of those films where you just, you know, you just marvel at these two characters, and also Joe Silver, who's also in it, who plays their friend, how they stand up to people. And it's a film I didn't mention on our Jewish episode that I did a while back. But this one is a really good, solid little film. And it definitely shows a different side of New York. And one I'm sure that the New York Board of tourism wasn't too fond of, to say the least. And so it's got a very limited release. I happened to run across it on HBO, and it also co-stars Janet Leigh, by the way. It's a hell of a little movie. It really is. It's one of those kitchen sink films that the 70s were really well known for. Do you know this film at all, Steve?
I know a little bit about it. I know enough, and I got a question. Any movie that has a line, "Oh, the rich people let places like this go to crap so they can come in and take over," why would a line like that piss off the tourism board?
I wonder.
This is one of the first movies to really get into the no bullshit way of gentrification. One of their plans, which was to let the place get so run down and rancid and bad that when they swooped in and took over all the land, they would look like conquering heroes.
Mm-hmm. That's true. It's a really, and in many ways, it's a sad movie because it really is eulogizing the old neighborhoods and how they are being taken over and how these people are being displaced. And it's a really good little gritty movie, and it's one that's not well known and one that I champion. So keeping with our New York thing, now we go to a whole different side of New York. And so at the end of these two episodes that I'm doing, we're going to have a watch, and I'm not going to say what it is yet, but there were three films we were talking about possibly watching. All three of them are absolutely magnificent films, And so, and I think we have actually talked about this quite a bit on our show, so we can leave this, go a little bit. But of course, I'm talking about All That Jazz, one of the greatest films of all time. Whether or not you call it a musical or you call it a drama, it is just fantastic. Yeah, it's both. And of course, let me finish. It's basically the story of Bob Fosse, and he's played in a surrogate role by Roy Scheider, and it's how he survives and how he deals with all the things he's dealing with being a Broadway director and a film director, and of course his love of death. And that he thinks he's going to die young. And let me tell you something. This is amazing. We actually played the last song a couple of weeks ago on one of my podcasts. So what's that? Yeah.
And you're forgetting
this
and
is a
his
great
thing
song.
Where he loved to fuck girls, but he wouldn't dump them. He would just be so cold and callous to them that they would leave him so he would look like the good guy.
Right.
And if you have ever woken up one morning and looked in the mirror and put on your fake face and your fake smile and gone out to the world basically saying it's showtime,
you haven't lived a
normal life.
It is a great, great film. And as I said, it's one of three films we considered. It's I would say, the second runner-up for our watch after these two shows. So, and again, New York is a
best film of 79.
Yeah. And it was certainly up for Oscars, too. But what I was just going to say is this is another New York film that shows a whole different side from a specific character. Okay, so we go on from here, and let's just talk about a couple of the films that were big. Of course, Rocky in 1976 was a huge film, and so inevitably there would be a sequel, and that would be Rocky II. This one is I think the best of the sequels until you get to Rocky Balboa, actually, which is the fifth in the series. But this is a good, solid, real film. It's not nearly as good as the original, but of course, it's following the whole beats of the original. But this one is definitely a big, big audience pleaser. And I was in there, the audience watching it, and people were just yelling and screaming and having a great time. So this is, if you want to have a good time, watch Rocky II. I would say watch the first one first, of course. What's your thoughts on this sequel?
I want to bring up a bit on a movie that came out next year, which was Richard Pryor Live in Concert, where you talk about white boys, white
Italian
guys
this year, by the
in
way.
New York where he lived.
That's this year, by the way. It is 79.
Oh, yeah, 1979. Well, we'll talk about this later, but he talks about how white Italian boys walk out of Rocky II thinking, yeah, I'm a badass, and dun-da-da-dun-da-da-da. And then they walk up and talk shit to a nigger, and then they get their head split.
Yeah, only Richard Pryor could get away with that. You really can't, okay? I'm just saying.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but yeah, I mean, really. I've really seen that people walk out of certain movies and they come out thinking they're bad. They wanted to be Rocky. Rocky was really an everyman. So everyone was like, yeah, we won.
Yeah, and the thing that I do like about the film is the ending where he and Carl Weathers, Apollo Creed, go at it. And it just stops right there to see who's going to win. I like that. And I did like the way it ended.
Stallone brought this out 2 years. You remember in Rocky III, there was a fight they didn't show between Apollo and Rocky?
Right.
So in the end,
I do,
Apollo Creed won the series 2-1.
Nice.
Yeah, so
nice.
I came out with that.
Okay, well, that's cool. Okay, keep going on. Now, the decade, all throughout the decade, you had films that were prescient in terms of social issues.
The moment.
And you have two of those this year. And the first one we'll talk about, Sally Field had an Oscar nomination for this role, and that would be Norma Rae. This was directed by Martin Ritt, who is a great director of the 70s, and talked about social issues a lot. His previous film this decade was The Front. This is just a good movie. I mean, to me, it's a little pat, but of course, the whole story is, you know, she organizes a labor union at her factory, and of course, you know, gets all sorts of crap for it, but she comes out and prevails. Of course, it's the American dream, circa 1970s. It's a good little film. I think it's a little bit whitewashed, but still not a bad film.
It's definitely whitewashed, because you know what? Real case where a real honest movie about that case came out maybe 1 or 2 years later.
Yeah, that it was a documentary, wasn't it? If I remember.
Yeah, and Silkwood.
And Silkwood, right.
Yeah, this was sort of a Hollywood Nice telling of the story of Karen Silkwood.
But it's a decent little film. It's a decent little
film.
Yeah,
and it worked better back when it came out than it would nowadays.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
Because people have forgotten the fight.
Now, the movie that absolutely did a number on real life. Okay, so there was a movie called The China Syndrome. And The China Syndrome is this thriller by Alan Pakula. I take that back. It's by James Bridges as the director. And it's the story of Jack Lemmon, who is working at a nuclear power plant. And while some reporters are there, played by Michael Douglas and Jane Fonda, there is an accident. And they release this film, and the Nuclear Power Plant Association, whatever they're called, you know, absolutely downplayed it and said, nah, this can never happen. You know, we're very good. This is clean power. And guess what happens 12 days later?
Let me lob a ball to you real quick, okay? In the first 2 weeks of this movie being out, it flopped. No one gave a shit about this movie. But on the third week it came out, it became the number one movie for months. And, Carl, why is that?
Well, because the Nuclear Power Plant Association, or whatever they're called, came out and said this would never happen, but it did 12 days later, and it's called Three Mile Island, and it was in Harrisburg. And, of course, I lived in Pennsylvania at the time, so it was huge news, huge news. And it's the biggest nuclear accident in the U.S., maybe not rivaling Chernobyl, but nonetheless, this movie just nailed it. I mean, it came out at the exact right time. And, boy,
out 2 weeks early, but...
Boy, did they just absolutely eat crow. And it's a good film. Jack Lemmon, who we haven't really talked about Jack Lemmon this too much. But Jack Lemmon in the 70s and in the 80s had a real run. He was a really good actor. And of course, he won the Oscar for Save the Tiger. We talked about that in 73. But Jack Lemmon had this sense of every man to him that when he was put in a position like this, and he has to go against the people that are above him and so on and so forth. You could just tell the anguish in that. He brought out this everyman anguish in his roles. That was just an amazing thing. And for those of you who don't know who Jack Lemmon is, you need to check him out. Everything from like the 50s, Some Like It Hot, on through the 60s, on through the 70s, and into the 80s. The man was a brilliant, brilliant actor / comedian. And this is one of his greatest roles.
Here's my short list for all you new kids out there. Some Like It Hot, China Syndrome, the two Grumpy Old Men movies. They're fun. He's good. And most importantly, the film that he went out on, Glenn Glary, Glenn Ross. If you're going to go out, you want to go out with something like Glenn Glary, Glenn Ross.
Okay, I would also add Shortcuts, and I mentioned Save the Tiger. And also, there was one other I was going to say with him. But those two specifically. Shortcuts is just amazing, and he's amazing in it. And that's an Altman film that comes out in the 80s. But, yeah, you definitely need to check out Jack Lemmon. Okay, so we go from Jack Lemmon. Let's do some stars here. We go from Jack Lemmon, then we go to Al Pacino. Now, Al Pacino became a great big name in the 70s. And he comes out with this movie, which is not one of his better films, but it showed how he could go over the top, and boy, does he. And that would be the film And Justice for All. Do you know this film, Steve?
Five. Four.
What?
I'm giving you five.
Three.
I'm giving you 5 seconds to apologize.
I apologize.
Then I want to ask you a question first. Who directed it?
Alan Pakula. It's not Lumet.
Didn't need Lumet.
No, it's not Lumet. Check it. It's not Lumet.
But still, Lumet,
I guarantee you it's not Lumet.
Yeah, it's good. It is very, everything in this movie is over the top. From the guy from Dynasty, John Forsythe, everything in this movie is over the freaking top. As a matter of fact, I think Pacino downplays it.
That's surprising. You might be right in that, actually.
Forsythe really goes over the top. Like the scene where he's flying Al Pacino in his helicopter and he's telling him how the hell it gives him such a great hard on to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting film. I liked it, but it just didn't have an ending. Set with me. Right, and it didn't have an ending. But it was a big hit. It did extremely well. So, we have a Al Pacino film. And now we're going to go on to the big Oscar winner of the year. And basically, I want to just take some Valium, or at least – exactly. It's a big film. The big film of the year was Kramer versus Kramer. God help us all.
Not God help us
Dustin
all, there's certain movies that I call movies of their moment. It's like watching some of the campus films back from the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
If you weren't there when it happened, you won't get this. It's like a foreign country. The whole idea of a father fighting for custody for his kids and having to fight almost losing battle because he's a man, that was a very pertinent issue back during that time.
True.
But if you make a movie about it, give it 4 or 5 years when the issue don't mean shit no more, it's going to come back to you and bite you on the ass and instantly age your film to a point where it's unwatchable.
Well, I think it was unwatchable from the beginning.
Oh, I'm not saying it's a good movie, but
it won all these Oscars. you know, Dustin Hoffman was up for Oscar and won. Meryl Streep was up. She did not win for
Crash
this.
Crash won an Oscar, Carl.
What?
Crash won Best Picture.
I know. I understand. I understand. And we're not talking David Cronenberg's Crash.
No.
It might not be as bad as Crash.
Still be like, what the fuck?
But yeah, Kramer versus Kramer. We had to mention it. That's all I want to do. But we'll keep going with the story.
Fuck you, all that
Go ahead.
Should have won. Fuck you, all that
what
jazz
was that?
Should have won.
Oh, absolutely. All that jazz should have won, but of course it did not. So we'll keep going with stars, and we'll talk about George C. Scott. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I love me some George C. Scott. I love this guy. From Patton to The Hospital to Exorcist 3, which, of course, is in the 90s. He was a great star. And he stars in a movie that is written by Paul Schrader and directed by Paul Schrader called Hardcore. Now, I know this is one of your favorite films, Steven, so I'm going to let you take this.
Yeah. And don't forget, one of his co-stars in the movie and gives a pretty goddamn good performance is Long Dong Silver.
That's true.
Yeah, he's the one who tells him not to go in there and all that stuff. It's a movie about a guy who comes to try to rescue his daughter from the porn. But the movie is not about porn. It's not about hardcore. It's not even about George C. Scott saving his daughter. It's about fundamental hypocrisy.
Well, okay, you're missing a big point here.
Yeah.
Who is George C. Scott? What does he do in this movie? What is he?
Isn't he like a minister or something? It's been a while since I've seen him.
He's a Presbyterian minister. He's a Presbyterian
right.
minister. And so the
and
movie really talks about the lack of faith and religion, which is really interesting,
yeah.
juxtaposed with hardcore pornography.
It's Schrader.
Oh, yeah. It is. It is definitely Paul Schrader.
To really explain that, if Schrader was raised by two overly insane religious people. The first movie he ever seen was Some Like It Hot. And because of his parents, he felt that by watching this movie, he was going to go to hell. That was any movie. But the thing is, he goes to rescue his daughter, and he adopts this girl. Who plays her?
Is it Linda Manns, I think?
Yeah, Linda Manns. And
yeah.
when he finds his daughter, he just throws her to the wolves and abandons her. So what hero comes out to be a cold-hearted son of a bitch at the end of the movie, which I find interesting. Even the so-called sleaze and pornographer guys are fucking nice to him. They're like, man, do you really want to see this? And, of course, it has one of the most over-the-top George C. Scott moments ever. And that's fucking saying a lot.
to say the least.
Make it stop! No. Make it stop!
Well, you know, he has one of those in every movie. My favorite of his is in The Hospital, where he goes and he says, "We heal nothing! We cure nothing!" I love George C. Scott. I freaking love him.
Hardcore is a good film, but I would put more in historical significance because of all the places that Schrader shot that just fucking gone. They're not exist anymore. Only on film and memories.
Yep. It's a great film. And it really established one of the people. Let's not forget about Paul Schrader, because he's one of the real architects of New Hollywood. He wrote Taxi Driver. He wrote Rolling Thunder. He wrote all these films that other people did, and now he's got a chance to be behind a camera. And he's turned out to be one of the most interesting, underrated directors I've ever seen. So, you know, very important person in New Hollywood.
Here's what most people are going to find weird about hardcore. It doesn't wallow in the sleaze.
Not at all. In fact, most of the sleaze is not shown on camera.
Yeah, because I see so many movies like that. Cruising, which I love, is guilty of this. It wallows in the sleaze. It's like, yeah, I'm going to show all this shocking shit and then turn against it. That way I can get away with it. It's an old exploitation trope, but I'm glad he doesn't use it.
No, he Schrader always talked about, you know, these characters on the periphery. And he was always taken by these characters on periphery. Now, it's funny we talk about Schrader, because I want to bring up a movie and give you a little... I'm going to bring up a film called Old Boyfriends. And guess who wrote it, Stephen?
Oh, it just now clicked in because I can remember reading a blah, 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 Raging Bulls in there. Didn't Schrader write that?
Not only did Paul write it, but he co-wrote it with his brother, Lawrence. And you said that this was actually completed. Yeah, Leonard. Leonard, sorry. So he co-wrote it with his brother. So this was a movie that was, this was a script that was around right after right after Taxi Driver. And they tried to sell it and tried to sell it, and he felt that since we've got a female protagonist, that it needs a female director. And he fought hard for over 5 years to get Joan Tewksbury to be connected with this film. Now, this film is very interesting in a lot of ways. One thing, it's one of the few movies that Talia Shire from Rocky ever really starred in. And she plays a character who's not really a good character. She's very unhappy. Her marriage breaks up, and she tries to go see her old boyfriends. And this was the movie that introduced me to an actor who I didn't realize until later how much I loved him. And unfortunately, he passed very young. And that would be Richard Jordan. Now, you know who I'm talking about, Steve?
Then some other films. His name sounds familiar.
Well, let me put it this way: he was in tons of films as a supporting. Best known thing is, if you know The Equalizer, he came in as Harley Gage when Edward Woodward had his heart attack.
And they soft-pedaled Schrader's ending, too.
Well, they did soft-pedal it a bit, but she still turns out to be quite a bitch. But this is this is better known for one reason, if it's known at all. And what would that be, Stephen?
I just checked before the show. It was re-released after John Belushi's death as a John Belushi starring vehicle.
Which he's only in the movie for like 8 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
He's in it for one scene.
Yeah,
he's
you
one of the
what
old boyfriends.
The original ending was going to be, don't you? She meets all of her old boyfriends and finds out how much of a bitch she was, and the ending was supposed to be her hanging herself.
Yep, exactly. No, she does walk away from Jordan in the cut, though, in the theatrical cut. She walks away at the end. But yeah, it's a really, really dark little movie.
John Belushi
did get
5 minutes.
Okay, you're interrupting. You interrupt all the time. I was going at something. Now I've forgotten it, Steve. What were you saying?
John Belushi was good in a dramatic role. Blah, blah, blah.
Oh, well, absolutely. Absolutely. what I was going to say was, it was really good that he held out for a female director on this. Because if he didn't have a female director and a balance there, it could have come off like a Neil LaBute movie, which would not have worked at all. Neil LaBute, of course, did the Wicker Man remake and just hates women. So he really – so that's one of the reasons where you thought that this was actually made and then not released. It was the script that was hanging around for a long time until he was able to get a female director. But I will say this. I really like this movie. I think it perfectly encapsulates sort of the female angst of the decade. And Talia Shire is absolutely brilliant. And she should have been up for an Oscar. But this movie, of course, just bombed because nobody liked it. Okay? So, but that is Old Boyfriends.
I don't want to say chronology either.
No, that's true. That's true. So let's lighten it up a little bit. Let's lighten it up a little bit. And let's talk about, though I have it in the dramas, it's a lighter film, but it is a great little movie. It is a movie that basically started the love affair of Malcolm McDowell and Mary Steenburgen. It also brought out how great a villain David Warner is. And what a wonderful concept of bringing H.G. Wells to modern times. All because of the director and writer of it, Nicholas Meyer, who I just reviewed, and we were talking about a movie called Invasion of the B-Girls on our last podcast. And I love Nicholas Meyer, better known for the Star Trek movies he was behind. He's also actually behind the new Star Trek Discovery, too. So I know you absolutely adore this movie, Stephen. I know you love this, so why don't you take this one? I love
it,
too, by
the
way.
And the one that most people don't talk about is I love the whole angle of David Warner, Jack the Ripper, shocked on how easy it is for him to do his shit in the modern world.
Oh, absolutely.
Like the one scene he goes on the corner, he's like, do you have anything I could kill someone with? And the guy in the alley pulls out a Mac-10, and he's like, "How? What?" He said, "How? What is that?" It's a gun. It shoots like 20 bullets at once. And then you see Warner's eyes just get big.
Warner is so good in this. We talk about – I love Malcolm McDowell. Everyone knows I love Malcolm McDowell. And Mary Steenburgen is just adorable in this movie. But he is – David Warner is just wonderful. From The Ballad of Cable Hoag, when I first saw that, I just fell in love with David Warner. And, of course, the Omen. And, of course, then he's the eternal – you know, the what do they call him in Time Bandits?
The Dark One.
David, the Dark One, yes.
Or
it's the devil or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, remember they call him, because if you say the D word around him, he gets very pissed.
I love David Warner. And he's just so good in this movie. So that is time after time.
And really, it's no insult to Malcolm McDowell with Mary Steenburgen, because she is supposed to be another woman out of time who loves the Victorian age and all that. And that's why she connects with him. But it's a great little thriller that seems to have gotten passed on by and lost in a shuffle, even among fans of the director.
Yeah. You know, and it's just a great movie. And if you have not seen it, you definitely need to check this one out. As I said, this year is just chock full of stuff. It really is. We're going to keep going here. And let's talk about another one. Now, I actually had spoken about this film when we did our Jewish show But Steve and I both love this film. This is a film by Robert Aldrich, who's better known for The Dirty Dozen and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane and all these films.
Yes,
and don't forget one of my favorite 70s films, which we talked about, Twilight's Last Gleaming. But this one is just one of the nicest road movies I've ever seen, a Western. And basically it stars Gene Wilder as a rabbi who comes into New York City and needs to travel across country to San Francisco to take on his new job as the rabbi of a synagogue that had just opened up. And he hooks up with Harrison Ford as a gunfighter, and they have to get across and have to learn to like each other. And it's one of those wonderful cross-cultural comedy dramas that is just a wonderful film. And it shows that Gene Wilder could really act. I mean, he really does a great role in this and does a great job in the role. And it's just a lovely little film, and it's really forgotten. And so I definitely want to re-mention this film and give it a nice plug because it's a great film. What's your thought on the Frisco Kid?
Oh, I loved it. But I love it, the first of the film when they come out skating, the two rabbis are saying, he could read the Torah, but can he understand it? And wait. And then at the end, after he's had to fight and all that to keep the Torah and respect the Jewish culture, he tells the big rabbi about it who's in town waiting for him. He said, you know what? What? Now you understand it instead of just knowing how to read it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's a great film. And it's a film that I know several Jewish friends of mine just absolutely adore. And it's a great, great representation of the Jewish culture.
Even
so,
Harrison
yes,
Ford
I,
loves
I,
the movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, Harrison Ford loves it.
Yes, he does. He thinks it's one of his best films, and I happen to agree with him. So another film I want to talk about. Okay, so and let's talk about another writer that starts to get some traction in the 70s. He does a little more in the 80s, but that would be John Sayles. John Sayles' first film that he wrote comes out in 79. And it's a nice comedic take on the life and times of John Dillinger and his latest girlfriend. It's produced by Roger Corman.
Corman.
New World Pictures. And it's a wonderful film. Directed by Louis Tigg, who would then go on with Sayles to give us Alligator the next year. And that would be The Lady in Red. You know, I haven't seen this in a long time, but I remember seeing this and just really liking this movie. It's just well written and well done and just a nice slice of life.
Yeah.
What's your thought on it?
Oh, I love it. And unlike most movies where it has the woman as the poor victim, it really stresses the fact that she gets off on the violence. That she enjoys
absolutely.
Being a bad guy.
Mm-hmm. No, but this one is a good solid film.
Feminine.
It's John Sayles had a great couple of books out and went out to L.A. and hooked up with Corman, and boy, he really put out some great films. But he also wrote some great ones, and this is one of them. So there you go. As we go with the lighter films this year, one of the films, okay, Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes had been a cinematic staple since the 30s and 40s. when Basil Rathbone played them. And generally when they played these movies, they played them, of course, as mysteries. And the whole idea was the mystery itself. As you go on and you rethink the character and for the time, just like Altman did with Philip Marlowe and my favorite film, which would be The Long Goodbye, people came up with different takes on Sherlock Holmes. And, of course, that's happening now, of course, with Guy Ritchie's two films that he did. But in 1979, Bob Clark, who at that point was best known for Black Christmas, would come out in the 80s with The Christmas Story, and, of course, there was Porky's, too, comes out with a wonderful take on Sherlock Holmes, starring Nicole Williamson, and also co-starring the best Watson that's ever been on screen, and that would be James Mason. And he comes out with a film which is an absolute brilliant, brilliant film called Murder by Decree. And nobody expected this film to be as good as it was, and it was outstanding. Stephen, go.
Yeah, and you know what the really bizarre part is, Carl?
What?
This is only the second Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper movie ever done.
That's true.
The only other one was A Study in Terror from the 50s. But I love this Sherlock Holmes. I love it because
Wait a second. Study of Terror. That's the one with John Neville, right? And with James Duty Kent. Right. That's early 60s, actually. Not late 50s. That's early 60s. I think that's 63. Go on.
But, yeah, this Sherlock Holmes is bound in duty to the Royal British government. And unlike most Sherlock Holmes who had this stiff back, this one takes more from the book, Holmes, who is willing to bend to fit the situation at hand. This is a spoiler without it being a spoiler because I just said he's willing to bend. The end shows Holmes playing a fiddle in the window, and he looks at Watson and says, "Did I do the right thing?" And Watson looks at him and says, "Well, what is the right thing?" And he goes, "You're right." And then it just shows them playing the violin as the movie fades out.
Again, it's an interesting take because if you take a look at the decade, and this is a decade of questioning and frustration and things like that throughout this decade, New Hollywood, this film definitely reflects that. This is not your simple, you know, he is the hero and that. There's a lot of shades here. Which also, you know, Nicholas Meyer did in the 7% Solution. So, you know, that was the first. No, that came out earlier. 7% Solution was 77. This is 79. But, yeah, it's a really good take. And it came out after 7% Solution, and it was Bob Clark, and no one thought it was going to be anything good. And it was absolutely magnificent. I think it's my second favorite Sherlock Holmes films of all time. It's a great film.
And Roger Ebert and Dean Siskel on their show went nuts over this film.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
They were actually kind of pissed that no one got nominated from this for an Oscar, which I do agree they should have.
Oh, I think James Mason should have. I don't think there's any question of it. And James Mason was not at the complete end of his career, but his career was definitely in twilight at this point. And he just gives such a wonderful, you know, nuanced, older version of you know, someone who has put up with Holmes all his life. And there's even some tension between the two of them. And it's really, really well done. So, you know, going on, I said there were three films that we were considering to watch.
Yeah. Carl? Okay, folks, Carl's gone for a second. We'll have him back in a second. But to Phil, yes, Murder by Decree was a great film, and yes, we did do three films. Carl seems to have dropped here. I'm waiting for him to call back because I don't know why he's calling back. But, yes, this is the year 79. If you really look at some of the directors and stuff that we're talking about, this really is the genesis of what the 80s have become, because Paul Schrader and the others really pulled it out. And, well, waiting for Carl to come back with his list. I'm sorry, folks. But, yeah, this was a very interesting year because you really started to see the 80s start with its inventiveness. Sorry for this interruption. And the goal is, wrong. I know what he is going to pick, but I want to go, let's see, look for something I know that Carl wouldn't really pick. There was, sorry folks, but Carl has this episode planned out and I'm really much lost without him. Who knows what happened to his phone, but yeah. I mean, 1979 was really a big year for me because I went to the drive-in a lot, and there was just so many movies, like Rocky II. With the, oh, Lord. Yes, I'm sweating bullets, and I can't handle it without a co-host. That's very good. Oh, Lord, where the heck is Carl? Gone for good. If he doesn't hit the next 10 minutes, I'm just going to go ahead and end the thing, but yeah. Oh, we're going to talk about one. I don't know if he's got it listed, though. I need to get his list, darn it. Okay. Sorry, I'm just nervous as hell without co-hosting. Really, this, we're probably going to have to redo this episode. I'm sorry, folks, but we'll redo this episode later this week. And sorry, but this happens. I hope to God Carl's all right. Your son just died. So, basically, see you on the redo.